Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
I'm your host, and we have a wonderful show for you today. Bob Kessler, our executive producer, is here to tell us more.
You remember that theme song? Do you recognize that one?
No, what is it?
Sneak Previews, the Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert show from back in the day. So we are going to the movies, Robert. You know what movie I'm talking about, the one that gives us an idea of how people in the past look into the future and what we can learn about it today. It's about the Minnesota experimental city. And also, Robert, you know, one might say when it comes to plastic pollution, it's not about how to get rid of the waste, but how we can ideally reuse it. And these people at Mac Rieber may have figured out something, so we'll meet them across the pond.
So today we're going back to the future, and that's all coming up on this edition of Green Sense. Sometimes seeing how people in the past look toward the future can help us plan for the present. A new documentary about the Minnesota Experimental City, a $10 billion project to build the city of tomorrow, was planned in the 1960s. It would produce minimal waste, little pollution, and use new technology to solve urban blight and overpopulation. It's a fascinating story of big ideas and big personalities. We're joined by Chad Fredericks, director of the film, The Experimental City. Welcome, Chad.
Thank you, Robert. Thanks for having me.
What attracted you to make a film about the Minnesota experimental city?
Well, number one, I was intrigued by its main character, Athelstan Spielhaus, who was a scientist inventor. And he dreamed up this experimental city as a way to treat the waste and pollution that were plaguing the American city of his time. And so I was intrigued by that, number one. And number two, I was intrigued by the scope of this project, as well as the kind of interesting personalities that were involved with this project. So all three of those together kind of made a perfect stew for me that just was too sumptuous to pass up.
Well, it was a nice stew that you brewed there. The project, as you mentioned, was a brainchild of Mr. Spielhaus, dean of the University of Minnesota's Institute of Technology. He was a big intellect, a big personality, as your film demonstrates. Was it challenging to present someone who's no longer alive and capture that big spirit?
I think in a way, if we had approached this without the kind of archival resources that we had, so you know, for your viewers or your listeners, you know, a lot of the audio is drawn from archival recordings of Spielhaus. And, you know, a lot of it is these kind of informal recordings of him just speaking to a friend. And, you know, had we not had that footage, yes, I think it would have been very difficult. I didn't know about those things when we started the project, but, you know, gradually found out about him. And the movie kind of started to form around those kind of more intimate moments. And, you know, when you're presenting a character, you're always looking for a sense of their personality, a sense of like kind of what drives them. And I think that, you know, we get that in those conversational recordings. And so, you know, we're very fortunate to have found it. Let me just say that.
Well, this project was long abandoned. How hard was it to dig up information and this footage of the project and all the other people that were involved?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, we were very fortunate. So I entered this project not necessarily having any idea what was out there in terms of archival resources. I was just intrigued by the scale of the project and the attempt to get it off the ground. But very early on in our research project process, we came across these recordings of what was called the steering committee, where they're discussing how to get this project off the ground politically, you know, what this new city will be like, what the priorities of this city will be, those kind of things. And we discovered 100 hours of those recordings. And so, you know, that was something that really brought the film to life in a way that we couldn't have otherwise. And so, yeah, that was the thing that was kind of the changing moment for us as producers, is to find those recordings and then to attempt to bring them to life.
This project was first conceived in the 60s. It was worked on in the 70s. And the plans were that the city was going to be built in the middle of rural Minnesota to test technology and urban planning ideas in the mid-80s. Even though the project didn't happen, what were the lessons that were learned from it?
People are always looking for lessons from history. I think there are several. Number one, I think, you know, there's a kind of historical lesson here about changing times. You know, the experimental city was conceived in the mid-60s, and this was an era when big programs like NASA and the ICBM program were getting off the ground, these kind of big crash programs, top-down government projects. And that's the era in which this experimental city was conceived. By, you know, 10 years later, when this project became contentious, that kind of idea of how to run a project, that kind of, you know, big idea about solving a massive problem, that was kind of coming under suspicion as people looked more towards the grassroots, kind of activism, people power, those kinds of things. And this project became something that was a target, whereas in many cases, 10 years earlier, it might have stood a better shot. So I think if one is looking for like one particular lesson, it's the importance of timing.
I'm Robert Colangelo. My guest is Chad Fredericks, director of the documentary, The Experimental City. Chad, what's the biggest reason this utopian green city idea never happened?
Well, I think one, it partly has to do with changing times. And so, you know, this was a project that, you know, that the 10 years on, things had changed where this project was going to be difficult to do. Number two, there was a resistance amongst people. So, you know, they actually got so far as to select a site for this futuristic city. But there was resistance from people who actually lived there. Now, there weren't a lot of people. There were about 1,000 people that would have been immediately affected by this city. But, you know, the last thing they wanted was a lifestyle change. And so they protested, rightly from their perspective, about having this city thrust upon them. In addition, there was a kind of, ironically, the city that was going to be pollution-free, and it had many kind of environmental impulses, was rejected by the mainstream environmental movement, partly because of its embrace of technology. It was something that the traditional environmental movement had a kind of skepticism towards. And so the combination of kind of public protest and resistance, as well as the environmental resistance and the kind of changing times against this kind of large-scale project, I think is ultimately what sunk it. And then, of course, the $10 billion.
Which seems like nothing these days.
About 100 billion.
Chad, what did you learn that you didn't know before you started this movie?
You know, I think probably one of the more interesting things that I discovered early on in the making of this was this kind of split within the environmental movement. As the kind of grassroots activist environmental movement got started in the late 1960s, that's the one that I kind of grew up with. You know, that's the one that I knew about. And, you know, most of my friends who were environmentalists had that kind of outlook, where one that was kind of vaguely skeptical of technology. I wasn't really familiar with this other approach to environmentalism, which is one that's largely driven by technology, finding large scale kind of technological solutions to these really, really big problems. And so that kind of split, you know, that is present throughout the film and certainly at its climax. That split was something that, you know, I wasn't fully aware of. And as I got deeper into this project, I was like, wow, gee, that's really interesting. And, you know, in many cases, we still have that mentality, that split today.
Has anyone thought about resurrecting the concept of the experimental city now that many of these green technologies are in place?
The experimental city as a whole, no, not as like all the pieces put together, but these various components are being discussed in urban planning efforts around the world today. You have a city like Songdo, South Korea, that has implemented a lot of the waste management strategies that would have been implemented in the experimental city. Obviously, the kind of computer internet kind of cell phone stuff that was being discussed back then, we've achieved that, if not more, than they would have ever believed. Interestingly, the dual mode guideway system, so this is a transportation system that was proposed for this city, is almost exactly duplicated by Elon Musk's recent proposal for what he calls the Boring Company, where there will be these tunnels and you'll have cars get on these platforms that'll be moved electronically. You know, that's almost identical to the dual mode guideway system of the experimental city. So a lot of the ideas that went into the experimental city, a lot of the technologies that were to build it, were things that ultimately have come to pass or that are being discussed today. We're kind of seeing a renaissance of that kind of thinking.
Were there any other ideas that you came across while making the documentary that have been applied today?
Well, I mean, the internet and the computers is probably the most obvious one. The idea of a dense urban core. Now, this isn't unique strictly to the experimental city, but it was discussed amongst many in design communities at the time. But the idea of this kind of dense urban core with a surrounding greenbelt. Right. The idea is that the city itself would not continue expanding out into the suburbs. You wouldn't have this kind of sprawl. The British tried this with their New Town movement back in the 30s and 40s. And whether or not that was a success, I suppose, depends upon who you ask. But in general, that's something that I think a lot of urbanists today would favor, the idea of a denser city. And it's something that allows people access to a natural environment. That was part and parcel of the experimental city concept.
What's your next film project going to be? Will it be a similar subject matter?
Well, I'm going to take a year off. I've been working nonstop on films for about a little bit over a decade now, full time. And so I think I'm due for a little break to kind of reassess. I've been telling these kind of historical documentaries set in, you know, vaguely in the 60s, 70s, 80s era. And so I want to give myself an opportunity mid-career here. I'm 40 years old now. And so mid-career, I think it'd be a good time to kind of step back and take a look. So my wife and I are going to be traveling the world as digital nomads, and hopefully we'll gain a new outlook, not only about how best to make the next movie, but also about life itself.
That's Chad Fredericks, director of the film The Experimental City. You can find more about it at mxc.com. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Here's one to file under, why didn't I think of this? The British company MacRibber takes plastic waste that would end up in landfills and uses it as a material for paving roads. They say it makes for stronger, leaner, and greener roads. And we're joined by MacRibber CEO Toby McCartney here on GreenSense. Well, Toby, thank you for calling all the way from the UK. We appreciate you being on the show. This idea seems very logical, very obvious. Had others ever tried this before?
No. Well, it's no. What we have is quite unique. Certainly, the mix that we have. So we have various different mixes of waste plastics, and it's totally unique all around the world.
Why don't you think others have tried this before?
Well, I think they have tried various different plastics before, but waste plastics hasn't really been a problem until relatively recently. So we just sort of hit the nail on the head, really. And with the waste plastic problem, we call it the waste plastic epidemic. The problem that we have now in the world is now, yeah, everybody's talking about it. So it's brand new.
So I found that ideas that look easy can be a real challenge to put in production. What's your biggest challenge and what makes your process so unique?
Well, I think our biggest challenge is it comes back to your original question, is that people think, well, surely everybody's doing this. I mean, it's so simple. It's such a simple idea. And we've got to go into engineers that have been working in the asphalt and the bitumen field for many years, and have done lots of research on bitumen and asphalt. But yeah, it's convincing them that that it really does work, and it is a simple idea. But unfortunately for them, they didn't come up with it.
So can any waste plastic be used in this process, or do you need specific types of waste plastic?
Yeah, well, in each of our mixes, we have four or five different mixes that go in to replace part of the bitumen in the mix, in an asphalt mix. And there's maybe sort of 7 to 20 different polymers that go into each mix that we put in. They all react differently together. So it isn't just old bottles and bags. There are various different polymers that we group together in various different degrees and percentages in order to make up a pelleted mix. And it is quite specific. They're engineered pellets.
Asphalt's pretty hot when they put it down. When there's plastic in with the asphalt, does that create any toxic fumes?
It doesn't. Plastic doesn't burn, or the plastics that we use from the waste stream, they don't burn until around about 220-230 degrees C. The asphalt manufacturers, the bitumen would burn off before any plastics, and they only go up to about 180 degrees. So it's nice and safe. There's no toxics released. We just need to make sure that the plastics fully melt into the remaining bitumen that's in the mix. And they homogenize in to create the full mix. So no, they don't burn, don't release any toxic gases.
As I said in the introduction, you've made these roads stronger, leaner, and greener. So tell us, how are the roads leaner from using plastic?
Leaner with regards to cost. So because we're using a waste polymer, a road is made up of various different things, really. There's aggregates, which makes up most of the road, but the expensive bit in a road is the bitumen, is the oil base. And we're taking a waste product or a waste plastic or waste plastics that don't have any value, and we're replacing part of that expensive bitumen with those waste plastics. So it makes the manufacturing of that road cheaper, less cost to make them.
Can you give us an idea of how much of a cost savings this represents?
Well, there's many cost savings, really. It's all down the line. So from the manufacturing perspective, our products cost less than bitumen itself, and certainly less than a polymer-modified bitumen. That's like an enhanced bitumen that you can find. But then the roads last longer. So what we like to do is use local waste for local roads. So we're taking the waste plastic problem away from the local authorities, and then the roads will last longer before they pothole, and therefore less maintenance on the road. So there's cost savings all down the line, and we come up with specific deals when we work with different asphalt manufacturers, depending on the price of their bitumen that they're buying in. We make sure that our products are less than that. So everyone's a winner, really.
Today's guest is Toby McCartney, CEO of MacReber, and we're talking about how they're using waste plastic to make roads better. I'm Robert Colangelo. Toby, is there a way that you can give us an estimate? Is that a 10%, 20%, 30% cost reduction when you look at all the total cost savings that you realize?
Yeah, it's difficult to say, to be honest, because there are various different road designs and different, it just depends whether it's going down onto a motorway like a highway or an A or B road like a country road. So it depends on the thickness. What we can actually do is save significantly, maybe 20 to 30% of the road cost if we're able to come outside of the standards that we have to adhere to. So if it's a private road, what we can actually do is reduce the depth of the asphalt, so reduce the amount of asphalt that needs to be bought, but still maintain the quality of that asphalt. So we're doing that wherever we have like private roads or airports or car parks. where there's asphalt, if we can reduce the depth of it, we reduce the cost by 20 to 30%, because we can reduce the amount of asphalt that needs to be bought.
Even if it was at the same cost, just being able to use this massive waste stream of plastic does tremendous social and economic good. So we're really happy to hear this. There's obviously, this is much greener because it keeps plastic out of the waste stream. Is there any other sustainable or environmental advantages to using plastics for roads?
Well, the great thing is all of our roads, all of the asphalt that contains our product can all be recycled. So the plastic's a great thing. It does so many wonderful things. It creates so many wonderful products that last for so long. Really, what we're using is the advantage of that longevity of those polymers, those plastics, in our roads. So the roads can be recycled, and it can be recycled again at the end of the lifetime of that road. So it isn't just using up those plastics once, it's using them many, many times in the same road.
How many roads are currently paved this way?
Yeah, well, we started out in the UK, and we have lots of local authorities now with lots of roads down here. But we also we went over to the GCC countries, so places like Dubai and Bahrain, over in Australia, and we're now in New Zealand, and just about to in June, we have our first trial going down out in the States and in Canada. So we're getting there. It's slow but sure, but it's we're as a business, we're only two and a bit years old. So we're just babies, really.
Well, that's fantastic. It's always good to highlight startups that are making a difference out there in the world. Could all roads be paved this way in any part of the world, or are there climatic issues that you have to take into account?
Yeah, no, they can anywhere in the world. We have different products for different temperatures, really. So in where I am in Scotland, we have a lot of cracking on the roads because we get a lot of rain, and then that rain is stored in little air pockets in the road. It freezes often up here. And then that freezing, as that water freezes, it expands, it cracks the road, and we get potholes. So we have a particular product, MR10, it's called, that gives a bit of flexibility in that road, so it doesn't crack as readily as a traditional asphalt. Whereas when we go to places like Australia or Dubai, we have a product there that creates a stiffness in the bitumen and in the asphalt. And it doesn't melt as readily as like a bitumen might. So when they get very hot conditions, it doesn't melt, and therefore it doesn't rut. It doesn't, when the cars and vans and lorries drive over it, it doesn't create rutting, and therefore they don't get as many potholes as they might if the bitumen were to melt. So anywhere in the world, we have a product for the asphalt that's going down.
Toby, what does your company do? Do you formulate different recipes and provide the product to contractors that build the roads, or do you do a turnkey project from concept to road?
We do a mix of both of those, really. So we take in waste plastics, we separate those plastics out, and then we put them back together, like making cakes, really, but plastic cakes for roads, plastic pellets. And then we sell those plastic pellets into the asphalt manufacturing industry, so your asphalt plants, and they then use that to replace part of that bitumen. So it's the whole process of taking in the waste. Some waste we get from commercial waste, some we get from our local authorities, household waste, and then we process that, we pelletize it. We bag that up, and then those bags of our pellets are then sent on to the asphalt industry.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. The big 900-pound gorilla in the room is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch with all the plastic in it. Have you looked at that as a potential source to mine?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of it. They call them gyres, where these mounds of plastic they sort of meet together in where our tides collide. The challenge that we have, and not just us, but the world has with those gyres, is in order to retrieve that plastic that's floating in our oceans, and then to take it and separate it, it becomes very expensive. So the challenge that we're always faced with, and any recycler would be faced with, is how do you get that plastic out of our oceans, but still make it cheaper than the product that you're going in to replace? And so we haven't yet been successful with that, but that is a long-term goal for us. We want to be using more of our ocean plastic, and helping to clean up our oceans too.
Well, speaking of oceans, thanks for calling in from that side of the ocean, and we hope you are successful at using your techniques to clean up the ocean. Good luck.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us on Green Sense.
Thanks for having me. All the best.
That's Mac Reber, CEO, Toby McCartney on Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. As the global population increases, the need for cost-effective environmental solutions that use less resources will increase. We need innovators who are willing to take the risk and pioneer new ideas. And that's what executive producer Bob Kessler does each week. He finds those kinds of guests. And Bob, what do you have for next week's show?
All right, Robert, it's going to be plants in... Hang on. I got to turn on the reverb unit here. Hold on. Plants in space. That's what we'll get into next time, how growing certain plants in zero gravity could make them more sustainable. We got a professor who's going to give it a try.
Well, visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. Now it's your turn. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.